Hello again, dear one. Last time, I showed you Rome trying to force the Earth to obey its ambition. Today, I want to sit with you beside someone different, someone who didn't try to conquer the world, but couldn't stop trying to understand it. Come closer. Stand with me for a moment on the edge of the Bay of Naples. The morning looks ordinary at first. Fishing boats rock gently. The water glints like polished glass. But something is wrong. The air feels heavy, as if it's holding its breath. Birds lift suddenly all at once, startled by something you can't yet see. Across the water rises a familiar shape, a broad, quiet mountain. Locals have vineyards on its slopes. Children play in its shadow. No one calls it dangerous. Mountains, after all, are supposed to stay still. But today, a strange cloud is forming above it, not soft like a passing sky smudge. This one climbs upward, tall and solid, branching like the crown of a stone pine. Dark at its base, bright and boiling at the top, people begin to shout, some run for boats, others freeze, staring. And then there is Pliny. He is not running, he is watching. I remember the way he leaned forward, eyes narrowed, not in fear, but in concentration. He has seen storms. He has catalogued winds and fires and earthquakes. This is something new, something the world has not yet explained. A messenger urges him to leave. The sea is changing, pulling back from the shore as if preparing for something terrible. Ash begins to fall, light as snow at first, dusting hair and cloaks. Pliny does not turn away. He asks questions. What shape is the cloud? How fast is it rising? What does the ground feel like beneath the feet? Others see danger. Pliny sees a mystery. He orders ships prepared, not only to escape, but to sail closer, to observe, to understand, to witness what the earth is trying to say. This is not bravery in the usual sense. It is something quieter, more unsettling. While the world cracks open, Pliny steps toward it, believing, truly believing, that if he can just look closely enough, the mountain will give up its secret. And that, my friend, is where his story begins. This is the late summer of the year AD 79. If you want to be precise, and Pliny would, you can mark the days as August 24th or 25th, though even the calendars argue about that part. What matters is that Rome is at its height, confident, busy, loud with power. The empire feels permanent. The world feels mapped. Pliny is in his mid-50s now, an admiral of the Roman fleet, a public servant, a man trusted with responsibility. But that is not how he thinks of himself when the lamps are lit and the house grows quiet. He thinks of himself as a reader. Pliny reads constantly. He listens constantly. He dictates notes while eating, while traveling, while resting his eyes. Slaves write as he speaks. Scrolls pile up around him like driftwood after a storm. He believes time is the one resource no human can afford to waste, not when there is still so much to know. And he has set himself a task that feels almost impossible. Pliny wants to describe the entire natural world. Not just stars and seasons, but plants and stones, medicines and poisons, metals pulled from the earth, creatures seen once and creatures rumored to exist. He gathers the observations of sailors, farmers, doctors, miners, scholars, anyone who has touched some piece of reality and tried to explain it. The result is a vast work called Natural History. 37 books, thousands of facts, some true, some mistaken, some strange enough to make you smile. Pliny does not always pause to judge. He collects. To him, the act of gathering is already an act of faith. Faith that the world is worth paying attention to. Faith that future minds will sort what he could not. Faith that knowledge, once written down, will not simply disappear. This matters more than he knows, because Pliny is living at a turning point, though he cannot see it yet. A moment when the old world feels stable, but the ground beneath it is beginning to shift. Empires like mountains can look eternal right up until they move. And so Pliny writes and listens and records, believing that if enough of the world can be captured in words, something essential will be saved, no matter what comes next. Let me tell you something Pliny rarely admitted out loud. His hunger for knowledge was not gentle. It pressed into every corner of his life. He slept little. He rested less. He believed that every idle moment was a kind of theft from the world, from the future, from understanding itself. While others talked, he listened. While others relaxed, he dictated. While others accepted what they had been told, he asked for one more source, one more account, one more scrap of experience. This kind of curiosity has a price. Pliny trusted books, he trusted witnesses. He trusted the idea that if enough voices were gathered together, truth would eventually rise to the surface. And sometimes it did, but sometimes it didn't. Errors crept in quietly, dressed in confidence. Rumors sat beside facts. Wonders were recorded alongside misunderstandings. He knew this. At least part of him did. But here is the human choice he faced, and this is the part I want you to notice. Pliny lived in a world where knowledge felt fragile. Scrolls burned, libraries vanished. Teachers died without students. If something was not written down, it could disappear forever. So he chose abundance over precision. Better to save too much than too little. Better to carry forward even the uncertain things than to lose them entirely. Better to trust the future to be wiser than the present. That choice shaped everything he did. It shaped the way he wrote. It shaped the way he read. And on that late summer day in AD 79, it shaped the way he responded when the earth itself began to speak in fire and smoke. Because when Pliny saw the strange cloud rising above the mountain, he did not see only danger. He saw a once-in-a-lifetime chance to understand something no one had ever described before. And in that moment, the same instinct that filled his bookshelves, the instinct to move closer, to gather, to witness, pulled him toward the shore. Curiosity is often praised as a virtue, and it can be. But in Pliny's life, it was also a weight, a pressure, a force that did not always know when to stop. That, my friend, is what makes him human. Not that he wanted to know the world, but that he believed knowing it was worth almost any cost. I didn't know, watching Pliny work, that I was standing at a hinge in the story. At the time, it just looked like energy. Urgency. A man refusing to let the world slip past him unrecorded. I watched him gather everything, carefully, faithfully, endlessly, as if the act of writing itself could hold the world in place. And for a moment in history, that felt enough. Pliny lived in an age that believed memory was simple. If you wrote something down, it survived. If you gathered enough facts, truth would take care of itself. He trusted that abundance would protect meaning, that the future would have the patience he did not. But I had already watched older cultures fade. I knew something he could not yet see. Memory is not saved by volume. It is saved by care. Pliny gathered before humanity fully understood that knowing requires choices, what to teach, what to repeat, what to guard, and what to let go. He stood just before that realization arrived, just before knowledge learned it needed hands, not just shelves. That is why his work feels both powerful and unfinished. He did not filter because filtering felt like loss. He did not teach because teaching felt like narrowing. He did not protect knowledge inside institutions because the ground beneath him still felt solid. And so when the mountain spoke, when the earth cracked open and offered something new, I saw the same instinct rise in him. The instinct to move closer, to record, to witness, to trust that being present was enough. This was the human stake Pliny carried, whether he knew it or not. He believed memory could be saved simply by gathering it. The generations after him would learn, slowly, painfully, that memory must also be shaped. And I watched, knowing that his way would not be the last. It could never be the final answer. When I step back from Pliny's life, just a little, I can see the pattern more clearly. I've seen it before him, and I've seen it return again and again. It always begins the same way. Humans discover a way to know more than they ever have before. New tools, new reach, new speed. Suddenly, the world feels legible, collectible, as if everything might finally fit inside the boundaries of language. Pliny lived at one of those moments. Scrolls traveled farther than voices. Books outlived bodies. Knowledge no longer belonged only to elders speaking to children. It could be stacked, copied, shipped. For the first time, it felt possible to own the world by describing it. I remember how hopeful that made him. He believed he was rescuing things from loss, and he was, at least for a time. His books became anchors. Long after Rome fractured, long after his own name thinned into ink and rumor, fragments of his work endured. Plants, stones, medicines, questions. But I have watched this pattern long enough to know its weakness. When knowledge expands faster than wisdom, people begin to confuse possession with understanding. They mistake access for insight. They trust that accumulation alone will carry meaning forward. Pliny did not yet know that memory, to survive, needs more than shelves. It needs paths. It needs repetition. It needs people trained not just to read, but to care about what they read. I don't fault him for that. How could I? Someone always has to stand at the beginning of the wave before anyone understands its force. That is why his moment matters, because every age that drowns in information believes it is uniquely advanced, and every age learns, eventually, that knowing more does not automatically make us wiser. Someone must slow the current. Someone must decide what is worth carrying across time. Pliny stood at the edge of that realization, with ash falling around him and the sea pulling back from the shore. And I watched, knowing the question he could not yet ask, but that you and I must keep asking now. When the world offers us more than we can hold, who will teach us how to choose? There is a temptation I've watched humans fall into again and again. It whispers softly, so softly it sounds like wisdom. If we can just know enough, everything will be fine. Pliny believed this, not foolishly, not arrogantly, but sincerely. He trusted that knowledge, once gathered, would naturally bend toward good, that truth would rise if it were given enough room, that future generations would have the clarity his own moment lacked, and sometimes that hope is justified. But here is what time has taught me. Knowledge does not guide itself. It does not correct itself, and it does not protect itself. Those are human tasks. Pliny lived before societies understood this fully, before they learned through loss that memory must be tended like a living thing, that facts without context can harden into confusion, that information without care can be as dangerous as ignorance. I don't say this to diminish him. I say it because his life marks the moment when this lesson first became unavoidable. Standing at the foot of that mountain, Pliny trusted curiosity more than caution. He believed presence was enough, that witnessing was its own kind of wisdom. And for much of human history, that belief carried us forward. But not forever, because eventually, humans would learn that knowing what happens is not the same as knowing what it means, that storing the world is not the same as understanding it, that progress depends not only on discovery, but on restraint, on teaching, filtering, remembering why something matters. This is the feedback loop I keep pointing you toward. We learn. We make mistakes. We build better structures, not because we are wiser by nature, but because we have been burned before. Pliny stands at the moment just before that burn became obvious. And that is why his story still matters, not as a warning against curiosity, but as a reminder that curiosity left alone will always ask for more than it knows how to hold. The question is never whether humans should seek knowledge. The question is whether they will learn, in time, how to take responsibility for what they find. When I think back to that shoreline, I don't remember the noise first. I remember the hesitation just before it vanished. Ash had begun to fall more heavily then. The air thickened. The sea no longer moved the way it should. All the small signals, the ones humans learn to read when survival matters, were already there. Pliny could have turned back. That part matters. He was not trapped. He was not foolish. He was choosing. I watched him look at the mountain, then at the boats, then back again, measuring something no instrument could record. Not distance or wind, but meaning. Was this moment something to escape, or something to carry forward? He chose to stay close, to observe, to trust that witnessing mattered. I want you to sit with that choice for a moment, not to judge it, but to recognize it. Because you stand in places like that more often than you realize. Moments when information rushes toward you faster than understanding can keep up. When the world offers more than you can safely absorb. What do you step toward? What do you step away from? And who taught you how to tell the difference? Pliny believed the future would know how to use what he gathered. In many ways, he was right. His words survived. His work endured. But his life also reminds us that knowing more always asks something in return. Not fear, not retreat, but care. So the next time you feel the pull to move closer, to read one more thing, to watch one more moment unfold, pause with me there on the shore. Feel the ground. Watch the sky. Ask not only can I know this, but what will I do with it once I do? That question, dear one, is where wisdom begins. And yes, my friend Pliny the Elder died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. He took his ship into the Inferno on a rescue mission, although he died there. That ship did manage to save the lives of his friends. Next time, I want to introduce you to someone who learned that lesson in a different way. A man who didn't just gather knowledge, but turned it into systems that could last. Who believed understanding wasn't enough unless it could be made reliable, repeatable, and shared. His name is Frontinus, and with him, we'll see what happens when curiosity finally learns how to build. Until next time, stay curious. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, one more thing before we go. I have a small favor to ask. If you enjoyed our time together, if this story stirred something in you, please take a moment to give History's Arrow a 5-star rating. It helps others find their way to these echoes of the past. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next step on our journey through time. Better yet, share this episode with a friend, a fellow traveler, someone who still believes that history matters. And if you're curious about my family, yes, the loud, glorious, divine mess that is the Olympic gods, I tell those stories too in another podcast called The Olympic Family. It's full of love, drama, and plenty of thunderbolts. You can find it wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, keep your heart open to the past and your eyes on the arrow.